The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. And I thought of continuing somewhat the topic of the last two Mondays. Taking a particular approach to exploring the Buddhist attitude, teachings around self and not self, and mostly avoiding the philosophical ideas around self and not self that the Buddhist tradition has, because I don't think they're that important generally, those philosophical perspectives, but rather looking at the more psychological aspects of this issue. Meaning that in the way that psychologically or mentally, we are active participants in creating our sense of self, our sense of identity. And then it's very interesting to look at our participation in this phenomena, rather than taking it as a given, that I am this, whatever it might be, is to look at the way it's formed, both by ourselves, but also by our society, our culture. There's a lot of factors that go into play. And a lot of what we think of as the self is a conditioned phenomena, constructed phenomena, is a fabricated phenomena involved with activities of the mind. And I thought today to explore this again in a little different way. And that is to try to have some exploration with you. I'll talk for a while on the virtue of humility, and it seems like a dangerous thing for me to talk about. Who am I to talk about humility? Who am I? I mean, you know, but if I say I'm not really worthy of talking about humility. That doesn't seem like quite right either. It seems like I'm kind of stuck, you know, you've just got to start talking without thinking about it. But I think it's a very interesting topic, being humble or sense of humility. In some places it's considered to be a virtue to have that. And I know for me that I've encountered people who, there's a very beautiful quality of humility or humbleness that has inspired me quite a bit. It's been very meaningful for me. And it helps me kind of become more empty or cleaner or kind of more lighter. In seeing those examples, I feel like I'm less likely to be caught or so focused on my own self-conceit, my self-preoccupation, my self-consciousness. There's certainly the word humility sometimes associated or being humble with feeling being inferior. And apparently the Latin root for the word humble comes from the word, one of the meanings, it means to be low, lowly, but apparently before that, earlier than that even, in Latin it meant the ground. And so people who are close to the ground are the people, you know, the peasants, you know, the low people. Some people, turn that around. It's like the word humus, has the same root in Latin. And some people turn around and say, well, it's a beautiful quality to be of the earth, to be kind of close to nature. We even use the word be grounded as in a positive way. So I'm inspired, I have been inspired by it. And I've also been quite dismayed by people who have a very strong self-deprecating attitude towards themselves, where they really feel like they feel really upset or angry or hostile towards themselves because they feel like they're unworthy. They feel like they're not as good as other people, and it can be very painful. It's a tremendous source of personal pain to carry that kind of attitude, and it's even worse when other people kind of insist you're that way too. They participate. They help you out. You know, you're no good. You're not. And we sometimes in our societies, in societies in general, we do it to whole other segments of society. And it's been pointed out that there's a kind of maybe more healthy attitude of humility is very closely akin to, in many religions, to being religious, and that people feel humble in relationship to what they consider to be sacred. It's not uncommon for people to get down on the knees in front of the altar or something. But then it can be overdone, as there's kind of a joke that maybe you've heard of, I'll put it in Buddhist terms. There was a Buddhist teacher who was sitting, meditating in front of the altar, and the Buddha, and exclaimed, "I'm nobody. I'm nobody." And so then someone else there, you know, another monastic something said, "Oh, me too, I'm nobody, I'm nobody." And so that's nice. And so then the janitor heard them. And the janitor came over and said, "I'm nobody, I'm nobody." And then the teacher said to the other person, "Look who thinks he's nobody." Kind of false humility. And you know, to the degree to which humility or humbleness is a virtue, it's a very strange virtue, because it's not something you can very easily cultivate directly. It's sometimes been said to be a very lonely virtue, because it's a humble virtue. Humbleness is humble, because it can't kind of claim itself, "Look how good I am, you know? Look how humble I am." As soon as you say, "Look how humble I am," that's kind of like, it doesn't work. And so you're kind of like, how do you, if it's a virtue and you can't claim it, and you know, you're kind of like stuck, well, what am I supposed to do? One of the things you can do, which I think is more the approach of certainly mindfulness of and vipassana, is we don't try to be humble. We don't try to be have humility as a thing. It's another construction or the activity we do. But we try to understand, one of the things we try to do is all the ways in which we're conceited, all the ways in which we're arrogant or we're caught up in sense of self. And to really understand that well and to see through it, to no longer believe it, or if we believe it, or somehow are caught in it, maybe start not taking it so seriously, or realize the limitations of that, or the falsity of that. And that, just kind of seeing through the conceit and arrogance is, you know, if you see through it, especially if you let go of it, what are you left with? Maybe in another person's eyes you appear to be humble, but you don't need to think that way. You don't care, right? You just work through this painful thing of contraction around self, and so then you don't need to hold that sense of self anymore, but you don't have to replace it with being now a humble person. You don't have to be anything. One definition of humility or humbleness that I really liked is to no longer compare yourself to anybody. So you're not, you know, to be humble, you don't only compare yourself as you're worse than anybody, you just not play the game of, you know, being somebody better or worse than anything. There's a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon where Calvin stands on top of a big hill, stands there proud and strong, and he says to everyone you can hear, I guess, "I am significant." And then I guess, as I remember the cartoon, I guess something like they pan out, and you see that on top of he's standing on this hill, but he's standing on the hill underneath the huge night sky, the stars and everything, just immensity of the sky, and he's looking up, and then he says in a very small voice, says the dust mote. You know, who are we? You know, to hold ourselves too proud and too powerful and too significant is a kind of conceit. But to kind of to dismiss ourselves entirely is just dust mote, is kind of, that's also a kind of conceit. Conceit that we're inferior. And this has been one of the great challenges, and I think that Buddhist teachings gives us around this idea of conceit, is that being considering yourself less than others is a form of conceit. And the alternative of not feeling superior is not to feel inferior. That's not a good humility to have, but rather not to be involved in comparisons. And then there's a very interesting teaching. I don't know if it's completely true, but it's certainly interesting to consider whether this is true for some of us. The teaching is that if you're shy, the shyer you are, the more conceited you are. What do you think of that? That's not what we think, right? Someone who's shy maybe kind of doesn't feel very... on the surface, it seems like someone who's shy doesn't have a very strong sense of self, is afraid, kind of pulls back, needs to be stronger, you know. But to be shy is to operate around a concern for self-image, self-reference, how you're presented to others, how others see you. And shyness has a lot to do with sense of self and how much we're caught and concerned with that sense of self. And if that sense of self is very strong, one form it can take is extreme shyness. It can take other forms as well. It can take extreme arrogance, for example, but it's still, at the root, this kind of concern with self. And to be humble is not to be shy. I don't think a beautifully humble person wouldn't be shy, just that because that's playing that self thing, self game again. So how do we work through that? I think we work through it by being very mindful of it, being very present, not believing it, not reacting to it, not judging it, but looking very directly at the shyness, learning how to be present for it so that it doesn't run us, but we're in charge of it, or say differently. So we're not being pushed around by our shyness and believing it, but we can look it right in the face and say, I see you. This is how it is. Or anything, arrogance, or any kind of sense of self, to be able to turn around and look at it and recognize it, not be embarrassed by it, not be angry with it, not believe it, but also not dismiss it. Just look at it clearly. Because it's very interesting to look at some sense of self, some self-construct that arises that we live by, to turn around and look at it. If you look at it, the one who's looking is not it. So if the one who's looking is not it, because you can look at it, then what's left? Who are you? Who's the looker? And then in Buddhism, if you look at the looker, if you turn then around and look at what's looking, you won't see a self there. You won't see anything that makes sense to call this is who I am. They're just looking. And we make this a world of difference between looking and being the looker. And if to keep looking. So in Buddhism, we keep looking and looking and looking, and we see what's really there. If you look clearly enough and steady enough and honest enough, it doesn't make any sense to kind of believe or be caught or be weighed down by the ideas of self that we carry with us, to be contracted around it. And so then we don't have to make comparisons. We can just be. And so we find in many spiritual circles, meditative circles, a tremendous emphasis on the value of just being. Just being, not being anything, just being, a sense of beingness, where we don't add onto ourselves a need to be successful or the idea that we're a failure or have to be kind, or that we have to be a kind person or an angry person, or, you know, all these ideas we have. And what is it when we drop all the ideas and just be? It's very powerful. The Buddha, in the few times where he referred to himself in a kind of in a more absolute way or clear way, he called himself, he didn't even call himself a person. He just would call himself such. I'm such. I'm thus. His title was Tathagata. Tatha means thus or such, and agata means the one who has come. The one who has come thus. That's pretty vague. Doesn't tell us much. at all. You know, now I don't know. That doesn't help me understand who the Buddha is. But maybe the external, internal experience of someone like the Buddha is not to fixate on anything as being a reference for this is who I am. Our awareness can be free. Our sense of presence doesn't need to have the Buddhist ideas. Doesn't have to hold a flag. Conceit in Buddhism is you hold up a flag and wave a flag. Here I am. Look at me. So there's no flag. There's no concept. There's no idea. And the beautiful thing I think to experience in something like meditation is the experience of being present, being alive, being energized, or being just aware. And that awareness doesn't have to be associated with any ideas. Doesn't have to be associated with any concepts. Doesn't have to be associated before and after. Doesn't have to be associated with proving oneself or apologizing for oneself. It doesn't have to do anything except just to be. And then there could be protests. You know, there's no monetary value in just being. You know, there's no the usual things that we want in our society that society champions. Not much is found in just being. You know, you got to be someone. You got to have a lot of friends on Facebook or something. So humility. So what is humility? So I said one way to kind of a healthy approach to humility is to understand all the things that stand in the way, all the conceits that we have, and see through them. Another way is to begin understanding more clearly the limitations of a human being. We're all limited. You know, we can't understand everything. We don't have infinite powers. I think it's quite significant that we use the English word mortal for human beings. Mortal means that we're mortal. Mortal means that we're going to die. Apparently the ancients, the Romans or the Greeks, used that word to differentiate those of us who die from those of us who, the gods who never die. That's what distinguishes us. But anyway, we're mortal. And there's a certain kind of healthy humility, I think, to realize our mortality, to realize, the limitations of our capacity, of our knowledge, of our everything. And sometimes it's a great disservice to one does a great disservice to oneself by being too successful and capable. Because sometimes if you're too capable, you can get carried along for a long time with the illusion, the idea that you're all powerful, all capable, and better than everyone else, and just can do something. So there's a story of aristocrat who came to the monastery, young man, capable, successful, well-educated. Everything he turned his attention to, he succeeded into quite easily. And he decided to become a monk. Came to the monastery, and first day the abbot said, "Well, why do you want to come here and be a monk?" And he said, in order to attain the full glory and power of the Dharma. So the abbot said, "Well, you should be careful what you ask for." So he sat down to meditate the first day in the monastery, and I'm capable, I'm sure I can figure this out well, and I'll apply myself, I'm diligent and disciplined. And so he really sat down, and sure enough, he was capable, and quite capable, and focused his mind quite well. And he got very concentrated very quickly. And then he could feel this tremendous focus, like a magnifying glass in the sun, and feel his heat arising, and this is it, I'm getting there. This, I knew I could do this. And then within a few minutes, he just spontaneously combusted, and all there was left was ashes on his cushion. And then, as these stories go, there was a peasant, peasant's son, who decided to join the monastery at the same time. And the abbot asked him, why are you here? What do you want to... "Oh, I want to see the Dharma in the food I eat, the work I do, in the face of the people I meet. And the abbot said, please enter the monastery. And he entered the monastery and looked for the Dharma and tried to find the Dharma in the ordinariness of every life, everyday life. And he lived in the monastery for a long time, very happy. Monastic life worked well for him. So what do you want to attain? The full glory and power of the Dharma? As quickly as your capable self can? Or is there some kind of way in which being humble makes the practice more successful even? Not being so proud and conceited and thinking, this is something I'm going to do as quickly as I can. There's a beautiful story, I think, of moving story of the Dalai Lama. I think it was in a conference in Arizona many years ago. Someone stood up in the big hall of people and said, how can I get enlightened as quickly as possible? And as the story is told, Dalai Lama stood silent for a long time. So that question just kind of hung over this, room of 1,000 people or more. And then, as it was told, at some point the Dalai Lama started to cry, started to tear. And then he said something about how, I don't know exactly what he said anymore, but he said something about how unfortunate that attitude was. How to be as to attain enlightenment as quickly as you can, the kind of arrogance or that kind of conceit, it's about me. So the other monastic story of the person who came to the monastery and said, I'm capable. If I work hard, how long will it take to get enlightened? The abbot said, 10 years. And then the person said, well, if I really apply myself hard, how long will it take? Oh, in that case, 20 years. And for the person that asked, what if I don't try so hard? And instead, am really honest about my self-conceit, ideas, identifications. What then? Then probably the abbot would say, oh, then probably a few months, something. It's so easy, if we look at the philosophical idea of self, that people want to defend it, or this idea of self. But if we kind of can look and see how whatever sense of self we have, ideas of self, how quickly it's a magnet for attachments. It's a magnet for very powerful feelings and emotions of fear and desire and hatred all arise out of the sense of self. And if the path to freedom from fear, the path of freedom from greed, the path of freedom from hate, is to let go of those things, is to soften the grip of those things, it helps a lot if we understand how this idea of self is part and parcel of the gripping, the holding. And I think part of the value of humility is to help with releasing that grip of self on us, so we're not so caught in ourselves and think we take ourselves so important. We are important, for sure. Everyone's important. Really important. And we shouldn't take ourselves so important. I think there's a difference between. So, the word humility is connected to being humiliated. Being humiliated is a terrible thing to have happened to you. But that's something that's being done, something's being done to you. Or you can humiliate yourself, I guess, do something to yourself. Being humble, having humility, is not something anybody does to us. I don't think you can make yourself humble, but you can make yourself honest. A great definition for humility that I read. Humility occurs when the love of truth is greater than the love of self. Humility is when the love of truth is greater than the love of self. So, we have about 15 minutes. And the intention here this evening was to say some words about humility, humbleness, to try to stimulate some exploration from all of us, to hear from your thoughts about the topic. And certainly you're welcome to ask me questions, but I'm much more interested to hear what perspective, thoughts, concerns, reflections, experiences you've had with this idea of humility or humbleness. So you can add, you can help today to build on the Dharma talk. So anybody want to say something? And if no one does, I'll just simply call on some people. Because we don't want, please, no false humility here. Please speak up. In the back. Can you wait for the mic, please?
I can understand what arrogance is. And I think of humility as being sort of the opposite, the lack of arrogance. And somehow I can hang on to that much better. Arrogance comes from comparing yourself to other people and finding yourself superior, for whatever reason.
It's a lack of arrogance.
It's a lack of arrogance. Mm-hmm. And then,
I wonder if the lack of arrogance, though, is the opposite of arrogance. Because, the opposite of arrogance maybe is self-debasement or something. The other extreme, and maybe...
But if you think of humility as being the opposite of... It seemed to me we got on a slippery slope when we were trying to say, what is humility? Is it debasement of oneself, or thinking of oneself as inferior of everybody else, to everybody else? And then all these funny questions about people making invidious comparisons with each other about their... the degree of their humility, whereas I don't know. It kind of dissolves the idea of humility. Uh-huh. Whereas arrogance seems much more concrete.
Great, thank you. I think I think what you're saying is great, and that's why I said earlier that that one of the ways of becoming humble in a healthy way is not to become humble, but rather to look at and be honest about and work through the conceit, the arrogance that is there, and then let when that drops away, let it be what it is. And someone else might associate that with, now that person's humble, but it wouldn't occur to you to think of yourself humble.
As one who has been called arrogant most of my life, I've had a variety of different experiences with, I've had situations in my life where I was sort of like a big shot, and I treated people poorly, and then I was confronted and humiliated and positioned. And those were very powerful experiences because I said, wow, I was really you know, way out of line. But I was so lost in my own delusion, my own experience, or my own self, you know, the sense of self, the self preoccupation, that it was destructive to the people around me. And, you know, in the community that I lived with, I got positioned and humiliated. And I was thinking about this practice, and it's a practice that you really, it's humbling. You, no matter who you think you are, at some point, you hit that place where you just go, oh, wow, I can't do this. I'm just going to, and for me personally, that's been one of the really powerful things about this practice for me, because I just sort of run in that way. I run, I can do anything, you know. And, but I can't not, you know, escape this experience that's just going to, like, it's going to consume, overwhelm me on some level. And I fail, you know, a lot, all the time in this practice. And I go, oh, okay, that's it, you know. And it's just, it's one of the great things about this practice for me, because I'm not harming people nearly as much as I used to by my activity, because I'm able to take this practice and come up against that in some ways.
Beautiful, so, on your own.
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, that's kind of one of the things that I've learned to navigate and engage and say, oh, wow, you know, I think I can sit through this. No, I don't think I can. I think I'm going to, you know, let it humble me, in a sense.
Beautiful. I think it's great. And here's a it's kind of building on what Richard said. It's an interesting statement that, first I'll say it, and then maybe I'll explain it a little bit more, that this, you know, Buddhist meditation practice is designed so you can have a lot of experience at failing. What do you think of that? Why would you want to do that? Why would you want to do something that gets you to fail? And to explain it is that if we see the sense of self to be a construct that's actively, we're actively reinforcing, living, making it occur, the mind is agitated, the mind is busy, it's doing. And as long as the mind is doing and active, it can't really be at peace. So as the mind gets more peaceful and calm, at some point what limits further calm is our sense of self. I'm the one who can do this, or whatever it is. And so then our attempts to keep trying to meditate are then limited and blocked by how strong our attachments are to self. And so when you're up against that wall, I can't do it, I can't do it, something has to give. The wall's not going to give. There is no wall, so it's not going to give. So at some point you have to fail, and in the failure you realize, I can't do this. And I've had many situations in meditation where when I finally realized I can't do this, that's when the meditation began. So I had to fail. But I didn't want to fail. I mean, I went kicking and screaming, and I wasn't going to give up that easily. And now, those of you who are blessed with no attachment to self whatsoever, and you don't bring any of that to bear when you meditate, of course, meditation is just a breeze. You just sit down and kind of cruise right into nirvana. But for everyone else, it's okay to fail. And in fact, I like to say that meditation practice begins when you failed. And many of us are perfectionists and to feel like, you know, and because when you fail, there's a number of things that can happen. One is you can be really honest and see what's going on. And that's the interesting time to start looking. So don't be afraid of failing in meditation. One of the good places to fail. So I saw a hand in the back there.
There's also one up there. You can tell me if there was.
So the reason I started coming here was I've been feeling kind of suffering lately.
Are you closer? Is it a green light?
Yeah, can you hear me?
There, yeah.
So the reason I started coming here was I'm, you know, suffering a lot lately, and I'm trying to find some way to ease my suffering. So this lesson is a little bit weird or difficult for me to understand, since I'm really motivated to come here so I can ease my suffering. Yet you say that, you know, if you're really motivated and you're really focused and you try really hard, that it's going to take longer. So I'm kind of stuck.
So, I thank you for asking that question, because I think it warrants some clarification. I think that the abbot invited the person to come in to be a monk, which is not an easy. It requires giving yourself completely over to that practice, with sincerity and dedication, and it's not for the lazy. So you have to kind of engage yourself. But how you engage yourself and the attitude you have is really important. So if you give yourself over completely, really apply yourself completely, and you're arrogant, or if you're conceited, or it's all about me, I'm going to be the best meditator on my block. There's a lot of things. There can be ambition or greed, or there can be the opposite. There can be, I'm going to really do this, but I can't really do it. It's impossible for me to do it. I'm not good enough. There's all these ways which we limit ourselves. And one of the important things to do is to look at the various ways in which we limit our efforts and shortchange and short-circuit our efforts. There's nothing wrong with making a lot of effort. It's how we make it and the attitude with which we do it. So some people who suffer a lot, the only thing that makes sense is to engage in the practice. Nothing else anymore makes any sense. And it's a beautiful thing to plunge into the practice and give yourself over to it completely. And you know, if you're a weekend Buddhist, you know, like, or what's called a nightstand Buddhist. There's a lot of nightstand Buddhists, you know, who, you know, this makes a lot of sense. They read a lot of books, and this is great. I'm going to do this. This is fantastic. Let's go to the bookstore tomorrow and get another book. You know, it's valuable to read books, but you know, at some point you have to actually do it. So I don't want to discourage you from giving it your all, but as you give it your all, you'll encounter, invariably you'll encounter limitations of some of the attitudes that come along with giving it your all. And you'll see the limitation, the problems that come, and then you don't give up when you see those limitations. You try to adjust the attitude. You try to find, how is a more useful way to hold this? And how to hold it more lightly, how to hold yourself more lightly. Not have too many expectations. And or demanding it has to be, or magical thinking, or believing that's, you know, there's a lot of things that can happen that we explore and develop as we do this. So is this addressing your concern, you feel, or you still feel like you came to the wrong place tonight?
I don't feel like I came to the wrong place, it's just not very easy to understand tonight.
Okay, so I hope I clarified a little bit. Okay, not to understand well something, because one of the things I was trying to do tonight was not so much, maybe it wasn't obvious, but not so much tell you something, but rather provoke you into thinking about something more deeply. And I was hoping you would think more deeply on this topic, so maybe that's done that for you. So, Sophia.
Okay, I just want to say something really quickly, because we're almost out of time. But the thing that came to me, I can't hear with this thing in my ear. is one of my ex-ministers, he gave a title of a sermon, and that kind of stuck with me. So just the title of the sermon is enough to make, you know, this whole thing. And his title was, "He Who Feels Punctured Must Have Been a Bubble." Think about it.
That's great. So don't puff yourself up. So, one more. Okay, we still have 2 minutes. So.
Okay, I'm listening to your not being shy sein, not to be shy. I experience humility as something that does not have an opposite, because the moment you're aware of that you have humility, you lost it. So there is no stepping outside of it. So I don't really think that it has an opposite. So
Nice. Yeah, so humility is like one of those things. It's like I don't know. It's kind of like trying to touch your right elbow with your right hand. You can't quite reach it. In terms of being, identifying that I'm humble, or I don't think it's something that we should be concerned too much about, being humble. But I think it changes the inner landscape. Changes our hearts when we appreciate the beauty of it or the value of it. Because, as I started the talk, I've been very inspired by seeing it in other people. And maybe they didn't think of themselves as humble at all, but I was inspired what I saw. And so to appreciate the beauty of it maybe changes something inside of us, and maybe the point isn't to try to be humble. The point is to be honest. So, I hope this gave you something to think about, and talk about. I hope that during the week you go back to your communities and bring this topic up with other people, and see what it provokes, and what kind of reflections it brings to you. So, thank you. So, next week I won't be here. Next week, Wes Nisker is going to come and give the talk. He's a Spirit Rock teacher, wonderful man. And then I'll be back, probably will be back in 2 weeks. And if it's okay with you, I think what I'll do is just keep talking about this issue of self and from a different angle. I think it's an interesting one. So in the meantime, I hope you have great practice. Thank you.